This is Andrew Peach with World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. Thanks for joining us. On the way, as COP29 draws to a close, how much should rich countries give poor nations to help them combat climate change?
They have committed to a provisional $250 billion per year, which is blatantly insulting to countries in the global south.
The world's largest man-made reservoir has been hit by drought. But what does that mean for the fragile economies of Zimbabwe and Zambia? And would you get in a taxi that didn't have a driver? We'll hear about the robot taxis in the Chinese city of Wuhan.
Robot taxis would not be able to drive in the center of Beijing. They would get stuck in the alleys.
Have you been in a self-driving taxi? We'd love to hear your story. Drop us a message at WhatsApp 0044. 330-678-3033 or email world.business@bbc.co.uk. COP29 is drawing to a close in Azerbaijan, but unless leaders there can snatch victory from the jaws of defeat in the last few hours, it hasn't been much of a success. It was never billed as a pivotal COP, but it was aiming to get agreement on a finance deal by which better-off countries would help poorer nations deal with climate change. The COP29 presidency proposed a figure of $250 billion a year, that's from rich to poor, by 2035, up from $100 billion now. But no one seems happy. Switzerland's environment minister, Albert Rosti, said there was no point in setting an impossible financial target just to get a deal, but was then asked by reporters in Baku how high the new figure should be.
Higher, much higher than the existing 100 billion, that is absolutely clear, but it can't be too high and non-realistic. That would be much worse.
Pakistan's former climate change minister, Sherry Raymond, told the BBC this is a matter of life and death.
For us, it's a fight for survival. It's not about finding money to create shiny new projects. It's literally a fight for survival on the ground.
Namrata Chowdhury is head of public engagement at 350.org, an organisation campaigning for a world beyond fossil fuels. I've been talking to Namrata, and this is what she had to tell me about COP29.
I have to say what seems to be coming out is what the Americans describe as a nothing burger. Disappointed is the mildest word I can use by what has been put forward as the most recent text. And as we speak, there are countries that are gathering to discuss whether or not they reject it outright. And civil society is also considering their consolidated response.
What specifically are you saying is inadequate about the wording that's being looked at the moment?
So as of now, they have committed to a provisional $250 billion per year, which is a drop in the ocean of what's needed. And that's what is blatantly insulting to countries in the global south. It's really unfair to be asking countries that have been hit so hard by climate impacts that they've had no role in creating, to ask them to go into further debt to cover the costs of their own adaption and losses and damages, and then incur debt on top of it.
I mean, just looking at the reactions we've got so far, they do seem to have alighted on a figure in $250 billion that literally nobody likes, because you've got groups like the African Group of Negotiators saying it's unacceptable. You've got the Europeans saying it's uncomfortably high.
And it's ridiculous. I'm glad you mentioned the European Union, because they are amongst the blockers. And from the intel we have, the United States and Japan are also being difficult on getting an acceptable grant-based sum on the table. The richest countries in the world are blocking the idea of raising the money we need to address the climate crisis. How outrageous is that?
I mean, are we just looking at politicians here who are heeding the wishes of their own electorates, who don't want their money spent on this, or perhaps feel that even European countries don't have the money to be able to afford more to spend on this than they're offering?
That don't have the money. Austerity is certainly not responsible for these ridiculous offers that we are seeing. When they talk about austerity measures and they talk about climate finance, they're having to find the money for it. This is essentially dodging the main question. It is unwillingness to pay up. So this, to me and to many to all of our movement partners, is a clear sign that the global north is simply failing to step up.
But couldn't that be because the leaders of the countries you're talking about are listening to the people who live in them, whose money this is?
No. Rich countries that continue to call these austerity measures and signal to their citizens that these resources are too scarce to invest in things like public services, social security, and climate action. These are claims that are both false and harmful. And if we wanted to fill the coffers further, the recent G20 declaration has already hinted at where that might come from, such as taxing the ultra-rich or taxing financial transactions. Aviation, shipping, other extractive industries could raise further trillions of dollars annually in public finance, which would mean unlocking those funds for climate.
So let me ask about the US. I mean, the US has been to the polls this month. They've elected a president who couldn't have been clearer that this was not going to be a priority in the administration that he hasn't even begun yet. But people knew that and voted for him.
Indeed. And that's part of what I said was the false narrative that people like the incoming US president have propounded for years. We all know the role that the media have played as well, corporate media particularly, that's often got funding that ties back to the fossil fuel industry. And we know the role they've played in creating this narrative of there not being enough money for public services, there not being money for social security, there not being money for climate action, none of which is true. If there's money to fund wars across the planet, there is money to fund security at home, there is money to fund climate action abroad.
What sort of number would you be saying to me, yeah, that sounds like an appropriate number? If $250 billion is an insult, what sort of number would you welcome?
Civil society has been saying $1.3 trillion per year. But it's about how that money is structured as well. It's fundamentally changing the finance system, which has historically penalized the poorer nations and increased their debt. And we need to stop that and stop that now.
And Namratri, if I had to press you to say, would you go for this, the wording that they're looking at the moment, which you don't like, or no agreement out of the COP talks at all, what would you choose? Because I guess that is the choice that the politicians and the leaders who are debating this right now are facing.
The current text, as it stands, is a very, very bad deal that countries cannot agree to. What we are hoping is to push the developed countries, the rich countries from the global north particularly, to get past their blocking tactics and to agree a far more just goal. We're willing to hold the line and hope very much that this COP comes through with the outcome we've been expecting it to.
And just finally, Namrata, does this system of COP talks work? Because we've seen an increasing number of world leaders not attending, and therefore it raises the question of whether they're being taken seriously, even as they used to be.
When they work beautifully. Let's not forget that the Paris Agreement came out of a COP as well. Let's not forget that in recent years we've seen the COP outcomes finally admit that we need to see a fossil fuel phase out.
Well, that's Namrata Chowdhury. Let's get away from the numbers for a second and into the consequences of all of this. The world's largest man-made reservoir, Lake Kariba, has been hit by drought. That matters because its water is used to supply power to Zambia and Zimbabwe, which already have fragile economies. Professor Harry Verhoeven is senior research scholar at the Centre on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University.
Since the late colonial period, when the Kariba Dam was being constructed, both Zambia and Zimbabwe have depended for very significant shares of their electricity consumption on the hydropower generated through different turbines on Lake Kariba. And for many years, that seemed to be a good idea, that seemed to suffice for the needs of people in cities and large factories. But in recent years, of course, what has changed is that as we've seen increasingly protracted droughts in southern Africa, affecting both Zambia and Zimbabwe, but above all also water volumes at Lake Kariba, is that hydropower's ability to meet those needs has declined and inclined quite rapidly, leading to today's situation.
So for anyone who's not been to one of these hydropower setups, it uses the force of water, usually running downhill through turbines to generate energy. And of course, when there's a drought, the water isn't there, so therefore you can't generate energy and there's no electricity.
Exactly. You know, there's multiple turbines in any kind of hydropower plant. And so what happens indeed is that when the water level in the reservoir declines is that you begin to shut down one turbine after another, hoping that, you know, the water levels will increase again so you can run the facility at maximum capacity and meet the demand. But what's happened in the last few months really is that one turbine after another has been switched off and is barely any power power being generated, both at Lake Kariba, but also at some other hydropower facilities that are important for Zambia and indeed for Zimbabwe. And this, again, complicates the economic picture very much.
And what's the consequence of that? You turn the power off, clearly it creates all sorts of ripple effects and in the end cripples the country's economy. Just talk us through what's happening with the two economies in Zambia and Zimbabwe as a result of what's gone on at Lake Kariba.
It's devastating, of course, because what it's meant is that for months now you've had power outages that don't just last 1 hour or 2 hours, which would be an inconvenience, but not a structural economic problem, but essentially no power whatsoever for 15, 16, sometimes even 20 or 21 hours a day. And that, of course, completely changes both the outlook for small businesses. Imagine, for example, that you're a mechanic or you're a hairdresser or you need a lot of refrigeration. It makes your business all but impossible. But similarly, also, of course, for operations like mining activities, and they're very important to both Zambia and Zimbabwe, as well as, of course, for factories. So in that sense, you know, the economic damage of this is very, very profound. And you know, economists aren't quite sure yet as to how significant it will be, but some estimates are already kind of hovering around 4 or 5% of GDP that will be lost. This is in Zambia this year due to the situation at the lake.
And you can't control the weather. I suppose governments could try to diversify their energy policy, but it's never quick.
Yes, I mean, the crisis, of course, at Kariba highlights two things. One is that clearly it's a bad idea to rely so much on this particular source of energy that is so climate dependent. But the second thing, of course, is that we're talking a lot about the economic damage that these power cuts are doing, mostly to people in cities. But what we haven't said yet is that about 90% of Zambians living in rural areas have never, ever had any access to electricity whatsoever. So it's not like the status quo for them prior to this crisis was particularly attractive either. And what that, of course, highlights is that you've had different governments in Zambia and indeed in Zimbabwe who for many decades have not invested very wisely in either diversifying their electricity supply or indeed extending it across the territory and making sure that economic growth is more broadly shared and that there is kind of this much broader contribution to GDP from people across the country as opposed to for mostly these kind of energy-intensive sectors in cities.
I mean, making big shifts like that is difficult, but are there any specific reasons why the governments haven't been keen to do that?
The general reason for this is that, by and large, governments in Southern Africa depend on urban constituencies, on urban voters, to keep them in power. That's really where political power is held, and very often, therefore, they are favored by governments in economic decision-making, even if, in the long term, this is clearly not very sustainable and not very wise. And this is a problem, of course, that, that we don't just see in Southern Africa. It's something that is prevalent across much of the continent. And a real shift that would really prioritize energy access for all, and that would, in a sense, bring people from across territories and across countries together, would therefore really require a lot of political courage and a willingness to do things differently. And unfortunately, that's been in short supply in many countries in recent years and decades.
And that was Professor Harry Verhoeven from Columbia University. This is Andrew Peach with World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. Let's talk next about what's happening with Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is on a streak of almost daily all-time highs since the US election, up more than 40% since then, very close to $100,000. Lily Jamali is our North America business correspondent. Lily, why is Bitcoin surging?
Well, Donald Trump's to do with why the price of one Bitcoin has touched almost $100,000 for the first time ever. And to understand the dynamic, it actually helps to rewind to before the election and how Trump pitched himself to voters. He pitched himself as the Bitcoin and crypto candidate. He spoke at industry events. He took donations in crypto. At one point, he even paid for a meal.
I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to come back to you, Lily, because the line isn't great, but we'll come back to you in a second or two because I'm interested to hear more about that. While we just sort that out, Chris Lowe, Chief Economist from FHN Financial in New York, is with me. We'll talk about crypto in a second, Chris, but let's talk about the Dow first of all, which ends the week at a record high. So this post-election rally continues.
Yeah,
It does. And, you know, we have seen some volatility in the week. There have been down days. There have been articles about the Trump trade losing steam, but it seems like every time it does, stocks go up again. And we're getting to a point now where valuations are extraordinarily high relative to the size of the economy. That is, we've gone from sort of a near-term reasonable expectation of gains to now pricing in extraordinary gains down the road. I wouldn't be surprised if we had a correction at some point.
Well, I mean, what you've just outlined is the recipe for a market correction at some stage, isn't it?
No, absolutely. And, you know, partly because even if you believe that Trump's policies are magnificent and are going to have fantastic outcomes, it takes time. And a good example of that is Argentina. When their government changed, there were radical changes. The economy actually bumped lower for a few months. Now, industry is booming, exports are booming, inflation has come from above 20% to below 4%, but it took months for that to happen. And in the interim, the stock market did, in fact, correct. It's one thing to think that Trump might be quite good with the economy. It's another to expect him to work miracles.
This time yesterday, we were talking about the European battery maker Northvolt and saying it had filed for bankruptcy. What's happened since then is the chief executive, the co-founder, has decided to step away.
Yeah, and I think this obviously has a lot to do with the fact they're the biggest supplier to Volkswagen. Volkswagen has its own difficulties producing electric cars. They're behind where they'd like to be. They're behind the rest of the industry. And it's gotten to the point now where they're closing plants in an effort to, you know, restore profitability. And then, of course, you have this election in the U.S. And one of the stated plans of the incoming administration is to end the regulations that are steering the U.S. toward an all-electric future. So there's quite a few negatives hanging over this story.
Stay there with me, Chris. Let's talk a bit more about cryptocurrency now. We were talking with Lily Jamali, our North America business correspondent, about this streak of all-time highs, nearly the $100,000 mark. And you were just explaining to us when your line fell off why that is, why it's surging right now. Tell us more, Lily.
Yes, and I apologize for that. The reason I think has a lot to do with Donald Trump, because you see that inflection point after the election. You said earlier, up 40% since the election, and this is because Donald Trump really pitched himself as the candidate that would, you know, help maintain the supremacy of Bitcoin and make sure that the U.S. was the capital of all things crypto. He even took donations in cryptocurrencies. So I think that it's fair to say members.
It sounds like we have further problems with our connection to Lily Jamali. So let's go back to Chris Lowe from FHM Financial in New York and ask you about cryptocurrency. Is this all about Donald Trump? Is it all about the US election, or are there other factors here as well that are pushing the value of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies up?
Well, look, Trump certainly has something to do with it. There's quite a bit of sort of pushback and scrutiny coming from US regulators. Those are all going to change after the inauguration. But I think it's also the fact that the BRIC countries, that's Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, have agreed that they are going to start promoting Bitcoin as an alternative reserve currency, an alternative to the dollar. And to the extent that that picks up, it could create extraordinary demand. I would warn people, though, if you are thinking about investing, it's a very, very volatile market. So you probably don't want to put all your eggs in that basket.
Well, that's the weird thing, isn't it? Despite the whole history of volatility, investors right now seem, you know, perfectly happy with that. They're not fazed by it at all.
No. Which, I mean, the sort of people who are eager to get into these digital currencies are, you know, they love these rapid increases. But we have had in the recent past, just a couple of years ago, Bitcoin over the course of a year was down by almost two-thirds. So extraordinary corrections not too long ago. It's just something to bear in mind. But at the moment, you know, you've got these potential structural changes. If the U.S. decides to start investing, for example, if the BRICS start building a war chest of Bitcoin, that's potentially significant demand.
Just finally, a quick word about Jaguar and its rebrand, which is certainly bold. It's come in for a lot of flack, and now Jaguar is hitting back. We seem to have lost that connection to Chris Lowe as well. No matter. Thank you very much indeed to Chris from FHN Financial in New York for being with us. I can tell you that there is bad weather in Los Angeles at the moment on the west coast of the States, which is why we're having some difficulty connecting with that part of the world right now. Let's talk about what's happening in China, where Tesla says it's aiming to offer full self-driving technology early next year, pending approval from Chinese officials. The firm has reportedly floated the idea of deploying this tech in taxis, but Tesla might find it's got some pretty stiff competition in that market. Jennifer Pack is the China correspondent for our US partners marketplace, and she's been trying out some of the existing robot taxi services, beginning in the city of Wuhan.
There are 16 cities in China testing robot taxis. The self-driving vehicles are mainly confined to a small suburban area in each city, and they usually come with a human driver for safety. Wuhan is the first to allow mostly unmanned robot taxis to operate in a bigger area, including a part of its downtown. To get there, news assistant Charles Zhang and I had to take a taxi driven by a human.
What did the taxi driver say? He said that he would never get in an autonomous vehicle. Why?
He didn't want to risk his life.
China's government actively promotes the autonomous vehicle industry, but it hasn't published data on safety incidents involving self-driving cars. Eventually, we find a human driver who is willing to test a robot taxi with us. Hey. Xiao Weiguo has been driving regular cabs for 14 years. He got into a robot taxi with me and Zhang. It's run by tech giant Baidu.
Safety is our top priority.
Baidu has the biggest fleet of robot taxis in Wuhan, about 400 cars. That's a tiny number compared to the tens of thousands of taxis and rideshare cars with drivers in the city. Still, Xiao Weiguo says driverless cabs could threaten his livelihood one day.
Once lots of robot taxis go on the market, people like me will lose our jobs.
But Lin Zhijun, a rideshare driver from Beijing, is more optimistic about his future. He thinks the layout of Beijing, with lots of narrow streets filled with bikes and people zigzagging, could limit the role of robot taxis. Lin Zhijun says the driverless cars seem to stop every time a pedestrian comes in front.
Robot taxis would not be able to drive in the center of Beijing. They would get stuck in the alleys.
But Beijing runs an advanced pilot on the city's outskirts to help driverless cars navigate better by equipping roads and traffic lights with cameras and sensors too, so they can talk to the autonomous vehicles. And this has some safety benefits, says Andrew Stokols, an MIT lecturer on urban planning. Like, say there's an 18-wheeler truck blocking a robot taxi's view of an intersection.
If the cameras on the intersection see the traffic's oncoming, say, around that obstruction, they'd be able to alert the car earlier as it's approaching the intersection, and it would be able to slow down or brake more smoothly.
What isn't smooth? The ordering process for a robot taxi in China. It can take 30 minutes and a number of platforms to get one. Plus, there are designated pickup points that are sometimes few and far between. But once we're inside the driverless robot taxi, it's kind of exciting. And when cabbie Xiao Weiguo got into a robot taxi with us back in Wuhan, he was excited too and called his friend on the phone. Look, he said, the robot taxi is going pretty fast, even a bit above the speed limit. But then we slowed down once we hit more traffic. And Xiao Weiguo wasn't too impressed with the robot taxi's road skills.
See, the car just stopped. If this was during morning rush hour and it stopped like this, that would cause a traffic jam.
We arrived at our destination 37 minutes later and paid $5. But without Baidu's deep discounts, the trip would have cost $14. That's a lot more than what Xiao Weiguo's taxi would charge. Plus,
the robot taxi doesn't change lanes very smoothly, so it can make passengers feel sick.
But he says self-driving technology keeps improving. He just hopes he can get to keep driving his regular cab until he retires in a few more years.
Jennifer Pack reporting from China. If you've been in one of these self-driving taxis anywhere in the world, we really want to hear about it. Drop us a voice note at WhatsApp 0044 330 678 3033, or email world.business@bbc.co.uk. I mentioned the COP29 climate talks are in overtime. You can follow the latest at bbc.com/news by going to the climate pages. From me, Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening.